Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. And also, we'd really appreciate it if you could rate and review the show on iTunes. On this episode, my co-presenter John Dorney is interviewing Dr. Brian Hanley on the recent death of former Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland and former Vice President of Sinn Féin, Martin McGuinness.
Brian Hanley and Martin McGuinness died last week. We're going to be talking today about his legacy. The first thing that came to mind to me when I thought about Martin McGuinness was that he was a so-called 69er in Republican vernacular. That is, he joined the movement as a result of the Troubles rather than as a result of pre-existing ideology. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And in some ways it might explain what's now a done-to-death cliche about his political journey. But Martin McGuinness was one of the kind of young generation of people who, in Derry, for example, there's a photograph from one of the bigger civil rights marches in 1969, and McGuinness is down the with a lot of people who look around the same age. And he himself talked about being out in the streets throwing stones at the police and actually throwing stones at the British Army, even when he was an IRA volunteer. So I think he very much came from a generation that was radicalised by what had happened in the late 1960s, particularly in Derry. I don't think he was on the first civil rights march on October the 5th. But what's interesting about that march
1968.
Again, in 68, yeah. I mean, what's interesting about that is that there was 400 or 500 people at that march. It was battened, and that was international news. But later that night, there was major rioting in the Bogside involving a lot of young people who hadn't been at the march, but who were then, you know, angered by what had happened to it. And that is something that you actually see over the next few years replicated across the North.
Yeah, Niall O'Doherty, for example, has made this point that in a lot of cases, it wasn't the agenda of the civil rights movement so much as how the civil rights movement was dealt with by the state that radicalised people.
Very much so. And also the way in which working class nationalist communities who'd have resented the police to a certain extent anyway, by 1969 were often in open conflict with the police. And I think one of the interesting things about Niall O'Doherty's book, for example, From Civil Rights to Armalites, is that he tries to look at Derry over a 3-year period almost on a day-to-day basis. In some ways, I think the difficulty for historians trying to examine the history of the conflict in the North is that it lends itself, when someone like Martin McGuinness dies, it lends itself to generalities, to talking about Martin McGuinness joined the IRA, Martin McGuinness became a peacemaker. When in actual fact, the decisions that people made in the late 60s and early 70s are often things, you know, very much locally driven, personally driven, things that happened to them or their friends. And that, but for an accident to history, might have turned out, you know, very differently. So in Derry in January 1969, you have rioting. Because the Burntullet March was attacked, there's rioting in Derry, again by lots of young people who weren't at the Burntullet March. It's a march by the People's Democracy Organisation, largely student-led, from Belfast to Derry, in theory emulating the Selma to Montgomery March in the United States in 1965. Very controversial, still regarded by many commentators and historians, particularly those who are of the unionist politics, as needlessly provocative. Goes through a lot of mainly unionist areas, is constantly harassed, eventually brutally attacked at Burntullet Bridge in County Derry, and then attacked again as it arrives in Derry because it goes through the waterside, which is mainly Protestant. So in reaction, nationalists in the Bogside then put up barricades. That's actually the first time that the slogan, "You're now entering free Derry," appears, and it appears in January 1969. But I suppose one thing that struck me was that it's during that period that a defence committee is established in the Bogside. That defence committee becomes very important in August because it oversees preparations for the Apprentice Boys Parade, after which rioting erupts, which begins the Battle of the Bogside, when Martin McGuinness and other youngsters are involved in effectively keeping the police out of the area. But people involved in that defence committee include Sean Keenan, who would be a 1940s veteran of the Republican movement, who was an early member of the Provisional IRA in Derry, and Johnny White, who was much younger, probably a little bit older than Martin McGuinness, had been a shop steward in the BSR factory in Creggan, who by 1969 is chairman of the James Connolly Republican Club, which would have been Sinn Féin in Derry. When the split happens in 1969-1970, Johnny White becomes commander of the official IRA in Derry. And a lot of the reports about McGuinness mentioned in passing that McGuinness joined the IRA in 1970. He joined the official IRA, and then very shortly afterwards he joined the Provisionals. And there isn't much explanation given about that. And I think a lot of readers, again, wouldn't really understand why he joined one and then joined the other, or what happened. He gave a little bit of an explanation himself in an interview in the with Nell McCafferty that was published in the Irish Times.
Let's come back to that in a minute. But just so what we're saying really is that the conflict that erupted around the civil rights movement in Derry, you know, made the Republican Martin McGuinness. But let's just step back a second. Martin McGuinness is working as an apprentice butcher in Derry. Would he have experienced a lot of discrimination? You know, would he have felt alienated from the state already? Or was it just the circumstances of conflict?
Derry was really the kind of standout example of discrimination in the north in terms of, firstly, electoral gerrymandering, because everybody knew that the majority of the city of Derry's population were Catholic, but it had a unionist council. Unionists were the majority. And that was, again, because the boundaries of the city had been drawn to allow a smaller number of unionists to elect more councillors. Plus, you still had, in the north, in 1969, property qualifications, which allowed business people and people who owned property to have more votes than people who didn't. Now, a lot of the people who lived in the Bogside or Craigan or other nationalist working class districts would have lived in council housing and may not have had any vote in local elections at all. So this was, the origin of the slogan, one man, one vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, people did have a vote in Westminster elections and in Stormont elections, but they didn't have them in local elections, which made a big difference in local government. Mm-hmm. So Derry stood out in that, for that example. And Martin McGuinness talked about the fact of going for jobs and knowing he didn't have a chance because he was a nationalist. Certainly Derry was marked by very high male unemployment among nationalists. A lot of nationalist women worked, however, at the time in the 1960s, I mean, the big industry locally would have been shirt factories, clothing manufacturing. Thousands of working class Catholic women and working class Protestant women would have worked in shirt factories. And in 68, 69, walkouts by female shirt factory workers are a factor in the kind of radicalisation and support for civil rights protests. One of the early spokespeople for civil rights in Derry is Ivan Cooper, who was later a Member of Parliament for the SDLP. Now, he was a Protestant shirt factory manager, and he was quite popular among the workforce. So a lot of the, you know, in 68, 69, you see a lot of women who work in factories that he works in, big supporters of Ivan Cooper, voting for him at elections and stuff like that, you see. So you've got so many different characters, so many different political forces at play, that the world that creates Martin McGuinness, the IRA man, is a pretty complicated world. It's not just as simple as he's radicalised by civil rights and then he joins the IRA. Because thousands of young Derry people rioted, but they didn't all join the IRA.
By the 1970, the situation in Derry was already pretty violent and pretty polarised. And it's in this context that he joined, first of all, the official IRA. So can you explain, first of all, why there was two IRAs at this time? Why Martin McGuinness might have joined one of them?
Yeah, well, there was two IRAs because the IRA split at the end of 1969, and that was followed by a split in Sinn Féin in early 1970. A number of reasons for the split. One was a long-running fracture within the IRA about the political direction that it seemed to be taking in the 1960s. Very crudely about political and engagement, ultimately about whether or not Republicans could take seats in parliaments like Leinster House. Also about involvement in social and economic activity. What's perceived to be a major shift to the left. Again, I think looking back on it, it's not that dramatic in some ways as it seemed to be at the time. But all this becomes really upstaged, if that's the right word, by what happens in Belfast and Derry in August 69. Now, in Derry, nationalists succeed in keeping the police out
of
the Bogside,
the Battle of the Bogside,
yeah. So-called. Things could have got very bad. I mean, one policeman, for example, opens fire in Derry, but generally the police don't use firearms, even though they're armed. It's mainly a battle of stones and petrol bombs versus CS gas and armoured cars and riot gear. The B specials are brought in, and things would have got very bad had they been sent into the Bogside, but they're not because the British Army arrive. Mm-hmm. However, across the north, the Civil Rights Association had called for protests in solidarity with Derry and to stretch the police. And in Belfast, demonstrations led by Republicans to stretch the police erupted into rioting. Geography of Belfast and the makeup of the city is very different to Derry. Mm. I mean, in Derry, you had local Protestants joining in support of the police during the fighting. Protestants from the Fountain, which is the working class, small working class Protestant district right beside the Bogside, they came out and they rioted in favour of the police, if you know what I mean. Mm. And sectarian clashes do happen over the winter in Derry, but nothing as bad as Belfast.
Derry is mainly the Bogside against the police.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. In Belfast, very quickly, you've got intercommunal conflict as well. And the IRA respond with the weapons they have. Ultimately, five people are killed in Belfast. Hundreds of people are injured. Hundreds of Catholics are driven from their homes. This puts the question of the North back on the centre of the agenda in London and in Dublin, creates a major crisis in the South as well. But in the IRA, very quickly in Belfast, there's an influx of people into the IRA. There's also the return of people who dropped out in the 60s, many of them with lineages going back to the 30s and 40s. And they argue we should have been better prepared, we should have had more weapons. Dublin were too busy with their political projects. There's a whole range of other rhetoric that goes along with that, some of which is about communism and the influence of the left. But Belfast breaks away first. And Belfast has already got a new IRA. It hasn't got a name during the winter of 1969. Along with people in the South who were critical both of what had happened in Belfast, but also particularly of the moves to recognise Leinster House, or tacitly recognise it anyway, you have the formation of what becomes the Provisional IRA.
If you can sum up in two sentences what the difference between the Provisional IRA and the Official IRA is in 1970, what would you say?
Not much.
Not much.
Okay. Not much to a person on the ground.
So it's about personalities in the early days.
Well, stepping back from it, you could see major differences. But I think to a young person who was looking to join the IRA, they'd have to be really driven. I mean, maybe a young Southerner who's very interested in left-wing politics would make a conscious decision to join the officials. And a youngster who might be very, very conservative politically might say, well, the provisionals are the one for me. But a lot of people join them on the basis that they're the only local group operating. They're the IRA as far as they're concerned. And in Derry, the officials were the much bigger organisation initially. So in Derry, for example, in Easter 1970, both sides have commemorations. And over 1,000 people turn out for the officials' commemoration and a couple of hundred for the provisionals. Now, that doesn't necessarily reflect membership, but the officials still have the dominant name in Derry. Similarly, actually, in most areas of the North, Belfast is the only area that the provisionals are the majority in to begin with. Now, when I say not much, that's a bit facetious because, of course, there are big differences. There wouldn't have been a split otherwise. But on the ground, you know, if you're looking to join the IRA, it might depend on who's the dominant group locally. And even the names provisional official hadn't really come into in the spring of 1970, they're still not very clear in people's minds, you know. Possibly one of the things that explains Martin McGuinness's longer-term decision is that he joins the Official IRA in Derry, and he later says that, you know, went to a lot of meetings where they were discussing various things, occasionally got given petrol bombs, which didn't work, and there didn't seem to be a focus. The officials really are confused, I think, by what was happening in the North. They politically believed in a role for armed struggle and in the use of arms to bring about a revolution. But they, from a pretty early stage, didn't think they were going to be able to drive the British out. In a lot of ways, they're very much influenced by the experience of the border campaign. And they drew the lesson from the border campaign that campaigns like that wouldn't work again. Whereas a lot of some of the provisionals who were involved in the border campaign drew a lesson that border campaign wasn't ruthless enough.
Didn't go far enough.
You know, Stéphane, for example, Sean McStéphane, who was the first provisionals chief of staff, he, you know, looks at places like Cyprus, where, you know, the Greek Cypriot guerrillas had waged a pretty ruthless war. And he says, well, you know, why didn't we do that during the border campaign? So
why didn't we shoot policemen? Why didn't we shoot off-duty soldiers and so on?
A couple of things about McGuinness. Personally religious, and I think that's beyond dispute. The provisionals, even though the officials weren't, in fact, the caricature Reds that people thought.
Not at that point, certainly.
And even their... Even their chief of staff, Cathal Goulding, would have said in interviews, we're not Reds, you know. Even though some of the officials in Derry might have been mass goers, certainly people like Johnny White would have been more secular and more influenced by the left. The provisionals would have been more comfortable for somebody who was religious, certainly. And that actually does become a big factor about 1972, when there's a kind of a increasing tension between both groups in Derry. But also, I think, primarily, if Martin McGuinness wanted action, and he saw, was beginning to see that ultimately the problem was the British. The provisionals said from an early stage, you know, damn your concessions, England, we want our country. That was on the front page of Yvonne Phoblacht. It's Sean McDiarmid, I think, but it's, you know, repeated by them. And essentially it means you're not going to get civil rights, you're not going to get equal rights while the British are here. The British have to be driven out. And the Provisional IRA, from its inception, is thinking about ways to fight the British.
So let's bring it back to Martin McGuinness specifically. Now, we've alluded to the fact that he joined the Official IRA, he graduated to the Provisional IRA, which is the more militant of the two. And what he said in that interview by Niall McCafferty is basically armies need to be fought by other armies. Now, the kind of contradiction there is that the British Army were not unwelcome originally in the Bogside when they came in because people perceived them as better than the B Specials or the RUC. What went wrong in Martin McGuinness's native Bogside between the nationalist community and the British Army?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, they weren't unwelcome. And again, one of the factors of life in nationalist Ireland, not just in the north, but it was a factor in Derry. Again, as becomes apparent by what happens in Derry, lots of young working class Catholics in Derry would have joined the Royal Navy or the British Army. So Catholics from the Bogside being in the British Army weren't rare, and they wouldn't have been viewed in any way like policemen, only for very doctrinaire. People like Sean Keenan would have said, you're a traitor if you join the British Army, but even a lot of Republicans wouldn't have taken that to mean an individual in their street. So initially the British Army arrive, and they aren't unwelcome, and there's some confusion. I mean, the leadership of a lot of the people in the Bogside, again, what was interesting about Derry was that people on the far left had a certain influence, like people like M. McCann, Bernadette Devlin. They are trying to, on the one hand, say, we're glad the British Army aren't going to allow the B specials in, but you've got to remember the British Army are the arm of the British state and they're not our friends. To teenagers on the ground, I think that becomes reality by the fact that by early 1970, the British Army are a constant presence. The police have more or less been withdrawn. Even though the police are being reformed to an extent, they're not back in the streets, certainly of places like the Bogside. So the British Army are the police. Now, they're the British Army, first of all, they're not Irish. All of Irish history is tied up in the fact that it's been occupied. The British Army are our historic enemies. They're the same age as a lot of young people in the Bogside. You do have a bit of fraternisation. Again, if you read the Derry Journal from 1970 to 1972, you come across plenty of cases of engagements and marriages between local women and British soldiers. But you also, from a very early stage, also have clashes between youngsters and troops. And after the Easter commemorations in 1970, for example, there's a lot of stone throwing and a lot of clashes, and the British Army are deploying troops in riot gear, and there's increasingly conflict. Now, in Belfast, you have deadly conflict much quicker. By the summer of 1970, the British Army have shot dead unarmed people in Belfast. That doesn't happen in Derry until much later. But certainly a section of working class Catholic youth in Derry would have been pretty hostile to the British Army from an early stage. And the Provisional IRA's explanation for why you should be hostile is pretty simple. I mean, this is the British Army. They're in our country. Get them out.
It's very much, you know, IRB, Irish Volunteer rhetoric from the early 20th century, isn't it? It's like the Provost version is Ireland should be independent and that's it. You know, there's not.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's pretty, I mean, I think one of the, you know, in the longer run, an advantage they had over the officials was that the officials were trying to explain why, you know, you could have a revolution, but, you know, it's not quite the time yet. Mm. Whereas the Provost were saying, well, the time is now. The British are here.
Yeah.
And certainly among the leadership of the Provisional IRA in Belfast and nationally, there was a realisation that this was the opportunity. I mean, if you've been in the IRA for years and you've talked about the campaign to drive the British out. Mm. And again, remember, I mean, I think this is, we sometimes forget this. I mean, the template in their mind is that in 1921, we'd nearly beaten the British.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, which usually Republicans put down to treachery, the IRA hadn't carried through. Now, if you think within 2 years, Martin McGuinness is sitting at a table in Chelsea with the British government, I mean, from the Provisional IRA's point of view, this looks like this plan is
it looks like the truce of 1921
Exactly. Yeah. And there is nothing like it. I mean, from throwing stones and petrol bombs in 1970 to 1972, over 100 British soldiers being killed in the north, there hadn't been anything like it in Ireland since the 1920s.
Exactly. So let's talk about that escalation. In Derry, Martin McGuinness referred to the shooting of Cusack and Beattie, which is in Derry a famous incident. Can you talk about the escalation of violence into lethal violence in Derry City?
Yeah, I mean, Belfast, bad things happen much more quickly. So by the summer of 1970, the British Army in Belfast have shot dead civilians. There's been the Falls curfew. British Army also at the time, I mean, they're working to their own template, which is colonial policing. So, for example, in the summer of 1970, the commander of the British forces in the north says that petrol bombs potentially can kill. So therefore, if you throw a petrol bomb, that's potentially one of my men being killed. So therefore, the British Army have the right to shoot petrol bombers.
And they shot plenty of people.
So they shot plenty of people on that basis that there were riots taking place. So this is, you know, never mind rubber bullets or CS gas. The British Army are using live ammunition against civilians. And they do that, you know, for quite a while. In other parts of the north, things go a lot more slowly. I mean, we know now, again, from a historical point of view, when we look at the War of Independence, for example, there's marked regional differences and people are trying to work out why Kilkenny isn't as militant as Cork and all the rest. Actually, if you look at the early 70s, all of the north is different as well. it always has its own tempo. The IRA in each place is different. The split takes longer. Tyrone, for example, which is latterly regarded as hardline Provo territory, stays with the officials until about 1972. The provisionals are much smaller there, you know. So it's things happen at a different pace. A lot of that depends as well on what the British forces do and the way they react to certain events. Mm-hmm. So Belfast really is the cockpit of the provisional IRA and of the worst violence to begin with. But by the summer of 1970, things are radicalising. And again, former provisional IRA volunteers from Derry have talked about how they were out every night with petrol bombs and with nail bombs, mm-hmm. you know, rioting and pushing things as far as they could. And more young people were engaged in fighting the British Army. And it's during rioting in the summer of 1971 that the British Army shoot dead two men, Seamus Cusack and Desmond Beattie, in Derry. They claim both are armed. Local people deny this is the case. Neither of them are claimed by any armed organisation. By that stage, you'd also had a fairly common litany of young people would be beaten up fairly regularly by troops. Troops would get revenge for having maybe been bested in riots by catching young people later on and beating them. They would then charge those people and invariably lie in court. And this was just the way it was working. You'd have again what you can only imagine for any young person. And again, it's that you're being stopped by troops on the street where you live. Mm-hmm. And you're being, you know, the level of anti-Irish or anti-Catholic prejudice would have been high. Even British troops who would have had no interest in that before they came to the north would learn pretty quickly that that was what you, how to annoy people. You'd have sexual harassment of young women, for example. You have a whole range of things, which mean that, you know, lots of people want to fight the British Army. And okay. The provisionals are saying, we've got the way to fight them. From early spring 1971, British soldiers are being killed in Belfast as well, so things are radicalising. And the provisional IRA in Derry are training.
The next thing to hit is internment, where McGuinness is not caught up. Several hundred people are arrested across the north and picked up, including in Derry.
Yeah. And again, a lot of the people caught in Derry would have been either border campaign veterans like Mickey Montgomery, who was an official, and people like Johnny White as well, who's interned briefly. Mm-hmm. The Stormont government's, you know, tried and tested answer to what they saw as Republican insurrection was special powers, interned without trial, and that had been used in the south as well on numerous occasions. They pushed the British government during 1970-71 to be allowed to use this. And as things get worse, you know, they're making their case that the only way to stop this now, there's a bombing campaign in Belfast, not anywhere else at this stage, but mainly in Belfast. Several soldiers have been killed, policemen have been killed, lots of civilians have been killed. So they're saying, we know who's involved in this violence and we can round them up. And it's absolutely one-sided. The only people who are arrested are either Republicans or people who've been involved in civil rights agitation. There's a mythology that they, you know, that they've got lists from 1916 or something and they arrest all these. I mean, they arrest a lot of people who are active in the IRA, and they particularly, internment particularly has an impact on the officials because a lot of them would have been quite well known, and it does affect their organisation. They catch a lot of provisionals as well. By the winter of 1971, there's, you know, in the cages of Long Kesh, there are provisional, official and non-aligned compounds, and there's lots of people in them. But I suppose they don't get a lot of the younger activists because they don't know them. They've also signalled, you know, more or less, if you're paying attention, you know there's going to be a roundup, so people are not staying at home.
Where was McGuinness? Do you know?
Well, Derry, you see, luckily for the IRA, because of the geography of Derry, I mean, the Bogside and the Creggan are up on a hill overlooking the city centre. They've got Donegal behind them, which is where a lot of people go both for hospital treatment or when they need to escape. By the summer of 1971, and particularly after internment, huge sections of the nationalist population are in revolt. Mm. So that means there's thousands of people on the streets. Mm. When the barricades go up in Derry, it's one place in the north where the IRA have a relatively free hand because the British can come in strength, but that'll mean gun battles, it'll mean a lot of trouble, or it'll mean being attacked by hundreds of people. Mm. So you have this free Derry becomes a reality, and that's again a factor in unionist rage, you know, and their demands to the British government that they do something about this by early 1972. But also in the period after internment, the IRA are able to operate to some extent more freely than they were in Belfast, for example, or in other areas. And I don't know why they don't get McGuinness early on.
Maybe they didn't know who he was.
Yeah, I mean, if the special branch in Derry were doing their job, I think they'd have noticed him by that stage.
Because he's nearly a year and a half in the IRA already.
Yeah, but they don't get lots of people that they're looking for either. And, and in Derry, I mean, they met fairly ferocious resistance when they went into the Bogside and Craigan during internment. So significantly, it's just after internment, the first provisional IRA volunteer is killed in Derry. And he's a guy called Eamon Lafferty. And he would have been quite senior in the provisional IRA as well. And he would have been around the same age as Martin McGuinness. And McGuinness talked in interviews occasionally about that. Lafferty is killed. I mean, classically, he is defending the area with pretty antiquated weaponry, probably a Lee Enfield rifle or something, against British troops. And he's killed. And I think McGuinness then probably does become the most senior activist in the... Given he's only about 21, it's very significant.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So a number of things transpired to remove barriers to McGuinness rising within the Provisional IRA. You've averted to one of them there. But another one is that a bomb, what the British called an own goal at the time, eliminated some of the Provisionals in Derry.
I suppose, again, when we look back, because it's ultimately 40, 50 years of a career in Republican politics, McGuinness certainly probably isn't thinking in 1970 about being a senior IRA man. One of the, I think, the reasons for the Provisions' early strength is that they're promising that this will be over pretty quickly because, you know, the British are going to be driven out, given...
Victory 72, I think, was
the 1972, the year of victory. And again, that's not... It's not quite as crazy as people, you know,
as it sounds
think,
now.
As it sounds now. And as certainly at the time, it would have seemed to have a reality in it. In the summer... The initial leadership of the Provisional IRA in Derry would have been, you know, older Republicans. So you had Sean Keenan, for example, whose son is killed in 1972 as well. You'd have Thomas Carlin and others who are older men. And in June 1970, they're making explosives, or they're experimenting with explosives in a house in the Bogside. And an explosion takes place and three men are killed and two young children are killed as well. I mean, that has a big effect because it's the first, you know, multiple deaths in the area. But it also means then that more older senior men in the Provisionals are killed. So it's younger men who are forced to come to the fore. People like Eamon Lafferty and then later on Martin McGuinness. And that probably accounts for some of the youth of the leadership. But you do find that elsewhere as well, that I mean, young single men or you know, men who don't have a lot of children are more willing to take risks as well.
But always,
that is a factor.
I think that's in any conflict situation. Yeah. You know, young single men do the fighting. Getting on to McGuinness's role in the IRA in Derry, which is actually quite controversial because it's tied up with, you know, responsibility for various things. But at the time in the early 70s, more or less everyone said McGuinness is the leader of the Provisional IRA in Derry. And according to Eamon Malley and Patrick Bishop's book, The Provisional IRA, McGuinness was made the OC in Derry by Sean McStiffon after internment. But according to McGuinness himself, he was the second in command. He was the adjutant of the Derry Brigade. Do we know what rank he held?
I'm wary, really, of trying to exactly pin down a lot of the responsibility for individual actions or also particular ranks and all that, because I really think we're probably talking about 100 years before anybody's going to be able to write.
Well, as you know, I mean, the IRA tends to keep paperwork, so somebody knows.
Well, somebody knows, and somebody may know, hopefully, if anybody's conscious enough of history to not, you know, destroy all this stuff, that in a century's time, somebody could try and write this in its minute detail. But McGuinness is being interviewed on television as the senior IRA commander in Derry in 1972. And he's, you know, that footage has been shown again and again of him walking around the Bogside talking about the bombing campaign, talking about the leadership in Dublin. He's identified in press reports at the time as the senior figure as well. And I think the Bloody Sunday inquiry was controversial, and the Provisionals were pretty late to agree. As far as I know, Johnny White and a number of former officials agreed to give evidence on what they had done on the day. And Johnny White and another person eventually approached McGuinness and said that it would make a mockery of the demands for the British state to come clean if the Provisional IRA would not take part. But personally, I think that their evidence is truncated. So
you think McGuinness was really the OC?
I don't see why there's some other figure none of us have ever heard of who really was, and he was second in command. But at the same time, you know, I think the point's been made in a good article by Tommy McKierney on McGuinness that the IRA have a collective leadership, and if he was in the leadership of the IRA, then he's responsible for a whole series of things. But the obsession with trying to say he's the man who did this or man who did that probably doesn't get us anywhere at this stage, you know. I mean, he was senior enough to be brought, but I mean, if he wasn't the commander in Derry, why did the British bring the second in command to London?
Exactly.
You know, it's
also,
you know,
anecdotally, if you speak to people who were there, they will all say McGuinness was the man. But So we're in, by the second half of 71, we're now in a situation which is much more lethal. I mean, according to some figures that I've read, 28 soldiers, British soldiers, are killed in Derry in that 6 month period, which is an awful lot. If you know Derry and you know the very small area you're talking about, you know, it's a pretty lethal situation. A lot of civilians are killed. McGuinness's role in this, do we know? Can we speculate?
Well, I mean, just that he is in charge of the Provisional IRA in the city, and like the Provisional IRA across Ireland, they perceive a situation now which has become all-out war. Mm. I think on Phoblacht in September or October 1971's headline is Total War. Mm. And they really think that potentially now this is, given the backing of people in the south, given the, you know, at least tacit support of large numbers of nationalists in the north, hoping that they get more and more modern equipment, they're looking at, from what we know, people like Dáthaí O'Connell, Seán MacStiafáin, are looking at the previous 20, 25 years of British engagement in former colonies across the world. Mm. And they're looking at Aden, for example, you know, they're looking at Kenya, they're looking at all these places where Britain had fought, you know, a pretty vicious colonial Cyprus, mm. you know, colonial wars where they'd suffered casualties, where they said they wouldn't talk to terrorists, but they always did, where they said they wouldn't withdraw, but they usually did. And therefore, I think they have a feeling that if we can destroy the commercial and economic centre of Northern Ireland, if we can cause multiple casualties to British soldiers in particular, mm. although you already begin to see that that starts to get more difficult, but certainly in the early stages, the British Army is engaging in a way that they'd now perceive probably as naive. You know, mm. they set themselves up as targets on occasion. You also begin to see more shootings of policemen, more shootings of Ulster Defence Regiment soldiers, things like that. One of which I think is early on in Derry is interesting as well in its own way. From what the Provisional IRA are doing everywhere, it's escalate as much as they can. And again, of course, Derry has been the site of Bloody Sunday in early 1972, which is not the transformative event in Martin McGuinness's life in the way that some of the commentators have talked about it, because he was in the IRA for 2 years already before Bloody Sunday. But it's certainly the transformative event, I think, the way people view Britain and the North.
Yeah, I mean, let's just deal with that quickly. I mean, I don't want to get too bogged down on what exactly he did, but, you know, there's a good phrase which comes from the Basque Country, from ETA, where they said their plan was action, repression, action. So action provokes repression, which produces more support for them, then more action and so forth. And I think you can apply that to Northern Ireland at that period of time. But Bloody Sunday is only one of many events where the British Army, you know, kills a lot of civilians mm. at that time. Martin McGuinness on Bloody Sunday, you know, let's just deal with it quickly.
I just don't know what he did. And I find, again, some of the discussion about it. I mean, a lot of the material that's written about it is to try and either, at one point it was to try and undermine the campaign for justice by relatives, because the British always claimed that they were fired on first. And even though that might not absolve them then of killing 13 civilians on the day, to a lot of people in Britain, it would absolve them. I mean, the official history of the Parachute Regiment, which is, you know, should be in the fiction bestsellers list, you know, that claim that they killed a dozen gunmen, the last time I looked at it, you know, a few years ago in a shop, dozens gunmen then secretly buried in Donegal, because obviously, you know, Irish nationalists are so callous that they wouldn't care, they'd never talk about these people
and
again.
And they hate funerals as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, one of the things about or not the IRA fired was to try and malign the campaigners for mm. justice. So, you know, I don't know exactly. And the other, you know, the book by Liam Clark and Catherine Johnson was very, very politically motivated. And that really set out to try and prove that McGuinness had done something which would take away from what the way most nationalists see Bloody Sunday, which is as an unprovoked massacre. Mm. Now, the fact is that the official IRA admitted at the time, and then admitted again at the Bloody Sunday Tribunal, that they had fired shots on the day, and one of them may have fired a shot before the main mm. massacre took place. Mm. I don't know if the Provisionals did. Yeah. But certainly, even though the Provisional IRA were already committed to a war, mm. what Bloody Sunday did was on television, in front of the world, mm. show that the British Army were capable of shooting large numbers of civilians. I mean, you're right, they'd shot lots of civilians in Ballymurphy after internment.
Yeah. Nearly as much as Bloody Sunday.
They shot at nine yeah. people, but it's yeah. over the space maybe of a day and a half or 2 days.
Yeah.
They'd shot civilians in other circumstances.
Spring Hill in Belfast, I think you heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a civil rights march on television. There's dozens of journalists. None of them see or hear this, you know, gunfire from the bog site that the British claim occurred. And therefore, it plays a particular role in, I mean, if you, it's a cliche, but it's also true, this is a turning point. It's a turning point for the way people view the North and Britain and the British Army. And it does radicalise even further nationalists. But for the IRA, the provisionals, it confirms what they already know, that, you know, that the British have to go. And certainly some provisional IRA leaders, I mean, Joe Cahill talks about in his memoirs how, you know, this was the great opportunity. We should have been able to build on this, particularly in the South.
Mm.
But, you know, for a variety of reasons, which we've talked about before, that doesn't necessarily happen. So I think that it has a huge impact in Derry.
Mm.
On McGuinness himself, probably not so much.
Well, who knows? I mean, he probably knew some of the people who were killed. So
sure,
sure,
but I mean, he was an IRA commander.
But he was already committed to an armed struggle.
Sure. Now, I want to talk about McGuinness, the IRA commander, because in lots of ways, that's his central role for the next 20 years. So one of the British officers who fought him is on record as saying he was excellent officer material, like he would have liked to have him in Sandhurst or wherever. And he certainly seems to have risen very quickly in the IRA. You mentioned he's a 22-year-old and he's brought in the IRA truce of July 72. He's brought to London, or brought to England to negotiate as not part of an IRA leadership team. What is it about McGuinness? He had a certain charisma or leadership skills, apparently.
I mean, he seems to have, and again, you're dependent then on the way that people, you know, have talked about him.
He rises very fast, though.
He does rise very fast. But again, the IRA would have been a relatively young organisation in some ways. And they've, you know, they chose both leadership figures from the South who are a bit more experienced and, you know, people from the North, including Gerry Adams, who were younger, although Adams had been around. He'd been a Republican. I suppose we never really talked about the fact that McGuinness doesn't come from that kind of lineage of
yeah.
Republican family and all the rest. He's a more typical Derry
nationalist, yeah.
But by all accounts, he's capable, you know, all the terms that go along with somebody being a leadership material. You can only, I think, look at what the IRA is doing and its strategy more generally than to see what he's supposed to have done with it.
Yeah.
Because things change a lot by the summer of 1972. When we look back at it historically, the momentum and the impetus and the what looked like the IRA's ability to drive the British out, in their own minds at least, I mean, that starts to slow by the summer of 1972. And by the winter of 1972, things are changing an awful lot. And though it may take them a couple of years to realise it, by the mid-1970s, you know, there's a very different kind of conflict. So the days of the barricades and of the, you know, wild gun battles lasting all night and the kind of very much the television footage of walking around the bogside with no mask on chatting to journalists, that does change and it becomes, you know, a different kind of war. And he just seems to be at the centre of the IRA for almost all of it.
Free Derry disappears in Operation Motorman in the summer of 72. The British Army retakes it. And like you said, it becomes a clandestine war thereafter. But Martin McGuinness, the following year, 73, was arrested in the south of Ireland on a weapons and explosives charge, and then following that he did a stint in the Curragh for IRA membership. But just, you know, I was writing an obituary on McGuinness last week, and it occurred to me that the sentences were still relatively light. I mean, someone who's arrested on explosives or weapons charges today, if they're in one of the remaining militant Republican organisations, will get a very severe sentence for that kind of thing. But McGuinness got, I think, 6 months. It seems very light.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, the sentences do seem relatively light, although things were tightening up. And by, you know, if he'd been arrested in 1975, 1976, he would have got a lot longer. But you were looking at a period where the South, both in terms of popular opinion and also at government level, was really unsure about how to deal with this conflict. There would have still been a great deal of, at least, tacit public acceptance of the idea of the IRA as primarily trying to defend nationalists. Although that was changing, you know, changed in the great scheme of things relatively quickly, but it still might have been the case by then. So each case, you'd have to kind of look at it on its own merits. I mean, there's a new book actually by a guy called Paddy Mulroe about the security policy on the border. I think he looks at a lot of this in quite, you know, minute detail about when you do begin to see shift in policing and shift in the way the courts deal with things. So it is relatively light sentence. He didn't do an enormous amount of time in prison in comparison to other people in the IRA.
Nearly a year, I think, cumulatively.
So he's pretty lucky in that regard. But I think he, by all accounts, I suppose what's interesting about that period is that he also gives the Bowdenstown Address in 1973. And it, I think in some ways, sums up the politics of the Provisionals when they were faced with this problem of stalemate. One of the reasons why the British were able to retake Derry was because of Bloody Friday in Belfast. And there's a big swing in public opinion away from support for violence.
Briefly, what's Bloody Friday?
By the summer of 1970... I think people are beginning to think that actually, rather than the British withdrawing, you're going to have a civil war. Mm. There's a big upsurge in killings of uninvolved civilians. The IRA have killed 50 or 60 civilians in bomb attacks at various stages. You know, one or two people have been killed, lots of people have been injured. But in July 1972, the IRA in Belfast decide to escalate with a whole series of car bombs in the city centre. Turns out to be a disaster. 7 civilians are killed. Loads of them are injured. Mm.
But there's how many car bombs?
21 car bombs.
21 car bombs. Yeah, so.
But it's followed fairly rapidly, actually, by 3 car bombs in the village of Clawdy in County Derry, which killed 9 civilians.
And McGuinness is alleged to.
Yeah, I don't know if the city IRA were involved in that or not. Again, I think it's pulled out of the hat because it's terrible and he can be, you know, associated. If he was in the leadership of the IRA, he's to blame for everything. I mean, I think that's, you know, rather than, you know, this kind of, you know, sure. or he takes responsibility for everything.
Sure.
The problem is politically that you have a whole series of bombing disasters. I mean, Clawdy is so disastrous, the IRA denied they were involved. Yeah. In Newry, 4 IRA volunteers and 5 civilians are killed. And that's another thing throughout 1972, especially outside Derry. I mean, this is another thing that's interesting about McGuinness and perhaps contributes to his legend. I mean, in Belfast, civilians are being killed on a really regular basis by bombs. IRA volunteers are being killed by their own bombs all the time. I mean, over half the IRA's fatalities in 1972 are from their own bombs. In Derry, the IRA destroy the city centre, but they don't kill any civilians, though they injure quite a few of them, and they don't kill any of their own volunteers either. Mm. So they are. Possibly does say something that he, you know, his efficiency and capabilities as a leader. I mean, the age is also, you've got 13, 14-year-old members of the Fianna being killed in Belfast, you know, and, you know, being killed by bombs or being shot dead by the British Army. So this is pretty horrible stuff. But this is sickening the population. I mean, the wider nationalist population are war-weary. Mm. And the British realise that. Bloody Friday gives them the opportunity, that's the bombings in Belfast, to conduct a major offensive to retake the no-go areas. And they work on the basis that the IRA won't resist them, and they don't. McGuinness and the rest move across to Lifford, as do the officials. And, you know, the IRA continues on in Derry City, but it's a different kind of war. Mm. But in 1973 at Bowdenstown, McGuinness gives a speech where he talks about the war. And he says, you know, problem is the people in the South and the government in the South aren't supporting us. And that unless you do, you'll be judged to be traitors. And it's basically very much, it's your duty to support us. If you don't, it's treachery. And it's very, you know, on the one hand, it's very emotive language. Mm. And on the other hand, it also completely, you know, shows a lack of understanding of why people might support you or might not, and about how to win support in the South in the first place. Mm. And it, you know, the Provisionals really by the mid-1970s are kind of grappling with that problem of how do you maintain this war? Can you get it back to the level of the early 70s, or do you have to do something else? And for some of the Southern leadership, that something else is actually ceasefire and maybe stop, you know, and I think that is another question.
And that's, so McGuinness gets out of jail in November 74. The IRA is on ceasefire for 1975, and coming out of that ceasefire, McGuinness rises again to a leadership role, along with another generation, with his generation really, of Northern Republicans. What happens there?
Yeah, McGuinness refers to this in 1986 of the Sinn Féin Ardèche when people like Rory O'Brady are opposing the move by the Republican leadership to abandon abstentionism, and he says, you've never taken responsibility for the disastrous ceasefire of 1975, and it's a really strong rhetorical weapon to use against them. You have a situation where ultimately, again, it will depend on whether or not we ever get access to the material, but The British government certainly gave both the IRA and the Irish government the impression that they were thinking of leaving. So the IRA, on the one hand, think there's a real possibility of a British withdrawal. The Irish government are terrified by this prospect, and a lot of that material is available. You know, they think there's potentially now, you know, they're going to be left with a civil war. But the IRA, some of the IRA leadership think the possibility of British withdrawal is coming. They don't think it's good. They don't think the British are going to pack up and leave in one day. I mean, they're talking about a 5-year. Even in 1972, they talked about, you know, phased withdrawal, you know, release of prisoners, troops back in barracks. Then ultimately, over a period, there'd be a rearrangement. And that's why people who had politics in the provisional leadership, like Rory O'Brady, or who had a particular political strategy, believed that then you would be able to set about the parameters of a new Ireland that would give the unionists a say and all the rest. So, you know, it's not just, you know, the average IRA volunteer might have thought the British are going to dive into the sea and swim, you know, and that's what some of them talked about, just driving them into the ocean. But, you know, their leadership did think that, of course, there'd be, you know, negotiations. Well, in 74, 75, there are talks and there are secret contacts. And there's also talks with Protestant clergymen. And the leadership of the IRA are worried about what's happening. I mean, they see it spiral out of... In Belfast, you've got sectarian killings every day, you know.
Mid-70s is the peak, actually.
Yeah, the mid-70s are the peak and the worst period. And it gets worse during the ceasefire. The IRA are also talking to the Loyalists. I mean, the Provisional IRA have talks with the UVF leadership throughout 1974. I mean, the people who bombed Dublin were talking to the IRA leadership. And this is something else that people don't reflect on now, you know. But there is, I think people in the IRA leadership, maybe O'Connell and O'Brady and others, think there's a potential for some kind of agreement, some kind of a new Ireland, ultimately, you know, and also they may think that things have gone on long enough. But a lot of the younger IRA volunteers who had joined in 69 or the early 70s had taken part in the early conflict, and then a lot of them been locked up or interned. They ultimately look back at Irish history, and I suppose they have this belief that in 1921, all that was missing was the last big push. I mean, Adams writes from Loncash under the pen name Brownie about the treachery of 1921, but more that really they didn't go far enough. They had victory within their hands, that we'll never be fooled again. And actually, during the early stages of the peace process, Martin McGuinness talked about this generation of Republicans will not be fooled by any fancy diplomatic talk. Mm-hmm. And that's what they think happened in 1921, you know. So they're saying, basically, we fought the British up to 1972 to the point where they spoke to us across the negotiating table. Mm-hmm. We can do that again. Mm-hmm. If we stop now, we'll be defeated. And people will see us as having given up. Mm-hmm. Maybe people in the south are losing the stomach, and that's very crude, because there's northerners who support the ceasefire and there's southerners who are against it. But, you know, ultimately, rhetorically, within the IRA, it's used as an argument to undermine people like O'Brady and O'Connell and others, and to argue that the war has been fought in the north and the war has to be led from the north. And if you want to point to the example of an outstanding northern commander, then it's Martin McGuinness. I mean, who's not centrally involved in the politics. I suppose what's again interesting, to jump back, in Loncash, you've got people like Gerry Adams, Brendan Hughes, who are influenced to a certain extent by people in People's Democracy, who are talking about the North being like Algeria, talking about the Loyalists being a colonist population who can't really be compromised with, talking about, you know, different types of strategy. McGuinness isn't really taking part in any discussions like that because he's not in jail. And they're also approaching this with the rhetoric of the hard left. We know that there's a way of seeing the North in colonial terms. And you can also then argue that the Southerners are conservatives, and again, whether that's reality or not is open to question, but you know, you can put that gloss on it. McGuinness isn't really directly part of those talks, but I think instinctively the idea that the war has to go on and we haven't been beaten and we shouldn't surrender would appeal to him. And then Derry is different again, because you always have the hinterland of Donegal and all these places. And the war is becoming more of an outside Belfast war. Armagh is becoming much more important. South Armagh, parts of Tyrone are becoming much more important, and there's a different culture there again. So McGuinness certainly seems to be one of those who want reorganisation, don't want compromise, agree with the idea of what becomes labelled, you know, the idea of a long war, you know.
I mean, McGuinness is part of this generation. Like you said, he's at the start, he's not one of the main figures, I don't think, but he does get made of, in a remodelled Provisional IRA, or IRA, we can call it, he gets made the commander of the Northern Command. They split it operationally into two parts. We're going to have to skate over a bit of detail, but basically, This analysis is that the problems in the north are that the British are propping up the system. Once the British leave, everything will fall into place. But the analysis of the peace process is the direct opposite, which is that the problem in the north is the division between the two communities. This is a peace process language. And the British role is basically irrelevant. The British are just, you know, trying to police this. At what point does McGuinness, or does he ever, start to see that one analysis is better than the other one? Or does he ever see that?
It's a mystery to me in some senses how you can kind of justify the compromises of the peace process with having believed at a certain stage that you couldn't have justice without the British leaving, because the British clearly haven't left. And that's not a rhetorical point about the peace process or anything less. The peace process accepts that the British are going to stay until the majority within the north.
Which is the opposite of the provisional analysis for
the provisional analysis. Well, one, I mean, the provisional analysis was, and I mean, I suppose at this point it's been rehearsed so often that people think it's a polemical point. Mm. It's not. Mm. The provisional IRA argued that Northern Ireland was an artificial, irreformable state that was imposed as part of the treaty settlement or counter-revolution, that therefore the last democratic choice the Irish people had made was 1918 or perhaps 1921, and that, you know, therefore there was no unionist veto. The unionists were an artificial minority within the north. Just because they were the majority there didn't make any difference. They were a minority on the island. They were propped up by the British. It was British guns that allowed them to have a veto, and that once the British removed those guns, the loyalists would have to make a decision. Now, you had people within the Republican movement. You always had then within that a whole range of views, from the most optimistic, which was that once the loyalists realised the British were leaving, that they would understand that ultimately there was a place for them in the New Ireland, and there was a whole series of structures, for example, the idea of Éire Nua, an Ulster Parliament where they would have a degree of power and influence, right across to the view which is more, you know, expressed privately than publicly, but certainly expressed in the mid-1970s, that if the loyalists are British, then they can go with the British. And if there's going to be a civil war, then let's have one. And that is, you know, that looks like the way it's going in 1975, 1976.
And again, anecdotally, you do hear that from like grassroots provisional supporters.
You hear it all, you know, the time. And yeah, it amazes me how it remains so subterranean when it's a view that is so commonly expressed.
Yes.
You know, it's you know,
I've heard it many times, I'll just say that.
and that, I suppose the strength of Irish republicanism is always that it tries to assert the idea that ultimately Catholic, Protestant and dissenter are all Irish. Mm. The reality often is that quite obviously a lot of republicans believe if the loyalists think they're British, then they should get out. You know, and you know, there's still the peace process has just, you know, confirmed that there's two communities who, you know, ultimately have different traditions and cultures and all the rest of it. So we're still on this merry-go-round of never, you know, and we're not going to get to the bottom of it now either. But, you know, the provisional certainly at some point realised that ultimately I think the war strategy wasn't going to work. Now, you can pinpoint a whole range of reasons or ideas why that might have been the case. But publicly, and again, this is, I suppose, what's important, publicly, in 1985, 1986, when Sinn Féin are winning council seats and Martin McGuinness himself is elected to Derry City Council, he gives an interview, which is on YouTube, where he says, winning council seats, winning elections is all well and good, but ultimately the only thing that will bring freedom to Ireland is the cutting edge of the IRA. At the 1986 Ardesh, he says again, you know, that, you know, if you leave this room with the people, with O'Brady, the only place you're going is home. Stay with us, we will lead you to the Republic.
And he says, we will never run the war down.
We'll never, you know, and privately, just as, you know, has occurred on numerous occasions in the past, right up to 1998, the IRA are being reassured privately that they can go back to war at any stage and that this doesn't make a difference. Now, I think, you know, that subterfuge, that whole tradition is deep, very deep in the history of Irish Republican military politics, which is always about, you know, evasions and lies, and where telling lies to your own constituency is perfectly justified, let alone anybody else. But this isn't, again, a moral stricture. This is how compromises are sold. Mm. You know, they're very rarely sold on the basis that, you know, in 10 years' time, we could be shaking hands with the Queen of England. You know, I mean, I doubt that would have been a great, you know, sell to the IRA in 1996, you know.
Well, I mean, we can talk about this from the new departure of the Fenians through Michael Collins through et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, in terms of McGuinness himself, so at some point, though, McGuinness must have said the armed struggle is not going to, we're not going to win, but B, that you can accept a settlement within Northern Ireland, we can redress some of our constituencies' grievances without winning. What point do you think he starts to think that? Because he clearly doesn't come on board with that kind of thinking.
I'm very wary of trying to imagine what Mark McGuinness thinks, you know, or thought, because, you know, I have no evidence, you know, that I've ever seen that'll tell you exactly what he thinks about, thought about certain things. But a product of working class nationalist Derry, who would have been acutely aware from a very early age that this was a majority nationalist city in which nationalists very crudely were second class citizens, I think will have certain assumptions. And also not being the product of either a family that would have talked about how important the 1918 election was or how important 1916 was in many ways, you know, not from this ideological Republican background. But I think for Martin McGuinness, Derry, Catholics aren't second class citizens in Derry. Catholics run Derry.
No.
Derry is a nationalist city.
Today.
Yes, today.
Yeah.
And, you know, the IRA in Derry, the provisional IRA in Derry, you know, they, from a very early stage, they, and it's noticeable in 1972 how a lot of the vitriol from the Catholic Church in Derry is really directed at the officials, you know, and the, mm-hmm. the Derry, you know, in 1972, the city centre that's been destroyed is a Protestant-owned city centre. Mm. Today, it's a Catholic-owned city centre, you know. I mean, a couple of years ago, they, one of the anti-agreement so-called dissident groups planted a bomb in Derry, and Martin McGuinness is a really vitriolic
traitors to Ireland, he called them.
Yeah, well, that was after the killing of the soldiers, but this was after a bomb attack at night on a bank in Derry. And, you know, again, cynics pointed out, how can he say this, the man who masterminded? Well, you know, Derry, in his view, is probably a completely different city now. You know, he would be on personal terms with most of the people who own Derry City Centre. It's not the same as bombing it in 1971, when the majority of shops in Derry barely employed Catholics. You know, this is unfortunately is very crude in a lot of ways, but, you know, the nationalists won in Derry. Mm. And I think for Martin McGuinness, that's quite a lot of the reason why he was fighting. It mightn't be the reason why some other people were fighting. And I think the Provisional IRA, like the IRA throughout its history, even the officials, and certainly the IRA of the Tan War, they were always coalitions. They were always people who believed different things and people who were driven by different reasons. Someone in North Belfast who's under constant attack by loyalists might see the IRA primarily as a force to fight against loyalists.
Yeah.
Others would see the IRA as being there to fight the British Army
and
would frown possibly on some of the things that, you know, the IRA and other areas might have done. Mm. There were people in the IRA who were, strange as it may seem, in 1970-71 in the IRA, who were horrified to think that their people in Belfast had killed off-duty soldiers. Mm. You know, you might think that's strange, but, you know, the idea they had was of the IRA taking on the British Army in this kind
it's
of...
It's an honourable war.
Yeah, an honourable war. Yeah. So it's always a coalition. There's people who think, you know, car bombing is a brilliant tactic to demoralise the British and destroy the economy of the North. Others who are horrified by the amount of casualties that it causes. So, you know, I think Martin McGuinness is the product of his environment, politics that made sense of his life in the early 70s, which was drive the British out and we'll be free. Probably by the 1990s, the realisation that both on the British side and the IRA side, that this was at a pretty grim stalemate. I think in the longer run, we may see as well that the IRA knew that nationalist support for the IRA, where there was support, wasn't unlimited. That, you know, there were certain things people didn't want to happen and they weren't going to go on forever sustaining this war either. The peace process delivered fantastic political advances. I mean, people now look at Sinn Féin and kind of assume Sinn Féin were always this strong. I mean, 1992, Gerry Adams lost his seat in West Belfast, you know, and at that point in the 1992 election in the South, most Sinn Féin candidates lost their deposits. Oh. In Republican North Kerry, Sinn Féin were getting around 600 votes, you know. So the modern Republican electoral success is the product of the peace process. It's not the product of the armed struggle. So Martin McGuinness, I think, if everything people say about him is true in terms of his intelligence and his abilities, he potentially could see that we're going to benefit a lot more. There seems to be, very cynically, a thing in Ireland that we're very fond of armed struggles that are a long time ago and that, you know, we don't really know anybody who was killed in, you know. And certainly, I meet a lot of people now who tell me that the IRA had no choice but to do what it did, who weren't alive or who were young when the armed struggle was taking place, and who knows what they would have thought when it was going on.
Sure.
You know, but, and that's, again, that's, their view is as legitimate as anybody else's, because, you know, I like to think that I'd have been supporting Michael Collins in 1920 as well, but I don't know. You know, the point is that actually, in reality, people's views on these things are always very complex and always very fluid.
Right. I want to cover two more things before we finish. So about Martin McGuinness's role in the peace process. Now, one thing which is very interesting, not much mentioned in the last week or so, was according to Ed Maloney's book, which is a controversial book, The Secret History of the IRA, McGuinness had a secret agreement with the British garrison of Derry, local British commanders, to wind down the war, the campaign in Derry from the late 80s onwards. He called it the Derry Experiment, and that this was a precursor to the IRA ceasefire of 94 in the rest of the north. Do you give any credibility to that?
Again, I suppose I have to be, from a historian's point of view, pretty dubious of something that I just don't see any evidence for. Because lots of things happen in Derry from the late 80s to the mid-1990s, including...
some nasty
things. Yeah, yep. I mean, including human bomb.
Yeah. Which is the proxy bomb, which was like an involuntary suicide bomb.
Yeah, including, you know, killings of loyalists and loyalist killings of nationalists, including bomb attack aimed at the British Army during the Bloody Sunday parade, which killed a young guy from Strabane who was standing on the walls watching the parade. You know, lots of things happen in Derry. So the idea that Derry suddenly becomes this oasis of peace and tranquility where there's this big experiment taking place, you know, very crudely, I don't see how that could have been the case. And I don't see how the IRA's leadership, which at the time are authorising these massive bombs in London, who succeed in mortar bombing the British cabinet, you know, in, is it February 1991? All these things are pretty, you know, they seem to me to mitigate against the idea that really everybody's running this down, you know, and that everybody knows, everybody involved knows there's a big plan. Yeah. I mean, I think that the problem is, sometimes political explanations aren't good enough for people, and there always has to be, you know,
a conspiracy
or treachery. And of course, in secret organisations and intelligence services, there obviously have to be conspiracies, because
there really are conspiracies, so that's the other side.
Yeah. But I think that, I suppose I would have to see a lot more evidence of that to give it any credence.
But let me put it this way, though. When, you know, we've talked about Derry is along with Belfast, the cockpit of the early troubles. And that's not true by the end. Derry is less violent than many other places by the end.
Yeah, I suppose there's a political explanation for that too. Catholics ran Derry by the early 1990s.
I mean, they kind of won already,
They'd, by the late 80s, early 90s, I mean, you had a situation in Derry where really the levers of power, the local civil service, the local bureaucracies, certainly the public service, the fire brigade, everything except the police, you know, had become like that, you know, a city that reflected its population. And to that extent, the British Army were still there and they were still resented because there was still lots of trouble and people didn't like them being on the streets. The police still would have been resented. The loyalists kind of upped their activities to an extent in the early 90s there as well. But Derry, the politics of Derry had shifted. Now, whether that's exactly the same as saying that there's this tacit truce or not, I'm not so sure. But I think that the nationalist population in Derry wouldn't have supported an all-out return to the early 70s. You know, they wouldn't have wanted that themselves. And that does make a difference. See, the point is, when the Republican movement starts to enter the electoral arena, I mean, you can think of this in a number of ways. In the 1970s, what are you going to do if you're a nationalist and the IRA set off a bomb in your street that breaks the windows in your house and everybody else's house? If you're brave enough, you can complain to the IRA. And the mythology would be that the IRA are the army of the people, so you can tell them what you want. But in reality, no, you don't. Mm. You know. And if you're brave enough, you might just say nothing. By the late 1980s, Sinn Féin are standing in elections. So they come around to your door. And now you can say it to the person on the door, if you want, here, listen, why should I vote for you? Do you not see what happened last week? Actually, people in Sinn Féin and Belfast by the late 80s are writing about the fact is that certain actions of the IRA are costing us votes. Mm. You know, that people have a way of punishing us. In Fermanagh, for example, Sinn Féin lose half their seats in the year after the Enniskillen bomb. I don't think that's unrelated. You know, there is actually a way of showing that you disagree, particularly when there's an armed struggle taking place. So in Derry, you know, there was a lot of anger over what was called the Good Neighbours bomb in 1988, where several people were killed accidentally by an IRA booby trap. And McGuinness was actually jostled, you know, at the funeral of one of those people. So again, there's a way people, it's not... You see some nonsense, you know, that almost talks about this being a totalitarian kind of state where nobody can criticise the IRA. It's much more mixed than that. And people can. And one way they can do it is, of course, is take it out on Sinn Féin. And I think in Derry, Sinn Féin would have been cognizant of that. They also still face the situation, of course, where Derry remained an SDLP stronghold. I mean, the SDLP's biggest trump card was John Hume, and he was the local MP, and he wasn't going to lose his seat, you know. It's only in the most recent election that Sinn Féin have outpolled the SDLP in Derry. And that possibly also put a bit of a cap on, you know, what you could do. So I think political as well as military explanations would probably, you know, account for some of the way things happen in different areas.
Okay, I want to wrap up now with the final question. So, you know, I think we kind of agree that Martin McGuinness, you know, favoured the peace process on tactical grounds, really. But, you know, the theme of the peace process, as we mentioned, was reconciliation between the two communities. Now, in fairness to McGuinness, he seemed to be genuine about doing this. You know, about... He very enthusiastically got on with Ian Paisley, for example. But he also did support a number of initiatives to try to reduce sectarianism. So, I mean, how can we reconcile these kind of contradictions in his life? That he really did seem serious about, like, trying to undo some of the harm caused by the armed conflict.
Yeah, I think, I suppose, at some level, you know, it's quite possible that Martin McGuinness never was sectarian. You know, I mean, it's quite possible that he never had any particular animosity towards Protestants per se. And also then that he does seem to have really taken all that, you know, what's called Verticom's outreach to unionists very, very seriously. And to have gone further than a lot of people, you know, other people would have done. And that possibly reflects personality as well. I mean, there's a story which has been published in a recent book about Protestants in the Republic about... In Derry in the early 70s, or in Donegal in the early 70s, there was a strike at a Protestant-owned butcher shop in Donegal, which got pretty nasty, which had very sectarian undertones. And the owner of the butcher shop thought that the IRA might attack him. And because he was in that business, he actually had a connection with McGuinness in Derry. And Martin McGuinness assured him that the IRA in Donegal would not, you know, do anything to him, and also that they would protect him if people did attack him. You know, it's just one of these little stories that perhaps point to an aspect of his personality which is genuine. Now, you can't, you know, there are so many people involved in Republican politics who personally do not have any animosity towards Protestants, but who then at the same time would talk about loyalists or unionists or all of these things, you know, in a way that would, you know, sometimes lead them to sectarian conclusions. And that's, again, I'm not trying to kind of judge them on that basis. I think this is an inevitability in a society that was based on sectarianism. But I suppose what's interesting for me is that McGuinness could do all these things possibly because he, you know, at times I wonder how political a lot of his, you know, thinking was. I mean, and it really struck me at the funeral. I mean, he didn't choose the people to speak at his funeral, but you know, Bill Clinton was one of the main orators. Now, De Valera and Collins didn't get a former American president to their funerals. This is quite simply stunning, given that the State Department up till the mid-1990s would have regarded the IRA as a foreign terrorist organization, as an ally of the PLO, as an ally of FARC, as, you know, the idea of an American president speaking at this funeral was strangely reflected on, I think, by the press. And then also this idea of, we're talking about decisions that Martin McGuinness made that led to death and whether or not he's responsible for all these individual deaths. Bill Clinton, as President of the United States, took decisions that led to thousands of deaths. You know, he actually, you know, only, I looked up how many bombing raids had been authorised under his presidency prior, you know, well before the Gulf War, the second Gulf War, and also, you know, the campaign of sanctions against Iraq and all the rest of it. And thousands of people died on his watch. Yet nobody thought to object You know, firstly, I didn't hear any Republicans saying that actually we shouldn't have this guy at one of our funerals, you know. Mm. So it's the whole perception we have of what we call terrorism, of the way that state violence is judged, completely different to insurrectionary violence. Mm. And also then of the politics of Irish republicanism, that you can have a Republican who will see meeting a monarch of a state he's fought against as a really significant point of making peace, you know. And even the rhetoric that goes along with that, when there's so many people in Britain who don't regard, you know, the monarchy as something that they want at all. So it's very much, you know, symbolism and how is this how we're going to live together and all the rest. And, you know, you can't knock the fact that actually most people in the north of Ireland are living lives now that they couldn't 25 years ago, you know. And he certainly seems to have played a major role in bringing that about. I suppose it also is depressing, of course, that away from the gloss of our media, which for once decided to take a very positive view of a Northern Republican, you know, within the Unionist community and among Loyalists, you know, still despised, still despised to a great extent, and many Unionists would believe that there was never any justification for any of the violence, and really that there wasn't even really that much discrimination, if any at all. I mean, a young member of the Progressive Unionist Party tweeted condolences and was essentially driven out of that party because she did. So that gives you some indication of how, you know, there are so many different interpretations still. And we, you know, in the South in particular, we've had a week of largely positive ones, unusually, but that is, does not do justice to either Martin McGuinness in the round or the conflict that shaped him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, what's interesting is the consensus among the media on these occasions, that they all tend to converge around a single point of view. But the last point that I want to make is, or point I want to cover, is I always remember, it just sticks in my mind, the first day of the Northern Assembly in 1998, and a succession, as it happened, of anti-agreement unionists spoke first, and all of them said, basically, there are terrorists sitting opposite, and they've been allowed into government, and they're not sorry for what they did. They've never apologised for what they did. They think it was they arrogantly say it was justified, in Sammy Wilson's words. Sammy Wilson is the last one to speak. I always recall the look of dismay on Gerry Adams' face, right? But Martin McGuinness had the steely-eyed expression that he got sometimes, and he fixed it on Wilson, and he gets up to speak. And he spoke in the language of the peace process, that you can't stop equality. You know, you can't stop the reform of the police, you can't stop Irish language, so forth. But what he's really saying, you know, I always thought is, I'm not one bit sorry for what I did. Maybe I'm sorry for some of the things that happened, but I think I was right. I don't accept, you know, this analysis that I was a terrorist one bit. And he seems to have kept this to the end, despite, you know, to some extent, the total reversion of his rhetoric. He was kind of unapologetic to the end, though.
Yeah, and I suppose that would be a strength, because why was he a terrorist when Bill Clinton isn't, or whoever else, you know? And why wouldn't he have, as, you know, a young man, react to the sight of a foreign army on his streets? I mean, the fact is the British Army are a foreign army, and they had killed civilians in Derry before the IRA killed British soldiers in Derry, you know? And it's, you know, I think that sometimes the argument from critics of the IRA is not just that the IRA should be sorry for what it did. And I would be, like anybody else, think a lot of what they did was absolutely horrific. But they should be sorry for existing, and they should be, there shouldn't have been any response, because what right do you have to respond to the state? You know, if there is discrimination, you should keep writing letters to Stormont or something, that it was wrong to march, that it was wrong. I mean, some academics, you know, really see the problem as the civil rights movement got going at all, you know. And I don't think McGuinness had anything to apologise for in terms of wanting to stand up for his community and wanting to fight, and that he could actually, you know, still hold that belief to the end of his days is probably, he obviously didn't feel that he'd done anything wrong in that sense, and there was no reason why he should.
Okay, Brian Hanley, thank you very much.
Now, thank you very much for listening to the show. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com /The Irish History Show. And again, if you could rate and review the show on iTunes, that would be really appreciated. Thank you very much.